Welcome to The Point. I'm Steve Junker, in for Mindy Todd. 2024 was the first year for the New Bedford Film Festival. It's back again this year, running April 10th through the 13th. The festival showcases diverse stories and storytellers with an emphasis on local filmmakers. Joining us to discuss the film festival and some of the films being screened, we have Ethan D'Aguiar, the founder and president of the New Bedford Film Festival. Welcome, Ethan.
Thanks for having me.
We also have with us Karen Kaiser, filmmaker for Women of Truth and Courage. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you for inviting us.
Lila Woodbridge, filmmaker for Interference.
Thank you for having us.
And Julian Pedro is with us, the filmmaker for Better Than I Was.
Excited to be here.
We will talk more about each of your films and others in a few minutes, but let's start with the film festival itself. Launching a film festival is no small undertaking. Ethan, tell us more about your vision for the festival, why you thought New Bedford was the place to launch this.
Yeah, I had submitted a documentary of mine to a swath of film festivals in 2022, and that experience, coupled with, you know, talking with filmmaker friends of mine who have had their own experiences with film festivals, we just kind of were like, why doesn't New Bedford have one of these? It seems like it would fit right in. New Bedford is very embracive of the creative arts. And we just kind of were like, well, let's make it happen and see how, you know, how possible it would be. So just gathered a team of passionate filmmakers to really make it happen. And I think one of the encouraging things we found was that the community was very embracive of it. It was, you know, people like to hear cool, crazy ideas in New Bedford and then help you run with it. So, yeah, that was very encouraging to see. And we just kind of, you know, took our experiences with film festivals ourselves and just made it happen.
You think that having been through the film festival process yourself, that you kind of had an idea of what you didn't want to do and what you did want to do?
Oh, for sure. I mean, there was, I less about what we didn't want to see. I don't think I ever went to a film festival where I was like, what is going on here? But it was more like, oh, that's a really cool idea. I can see like a New Bedford version of this, or I can see like how I would kind of tweak this a little bit, or, you know, something that they did. I remember going to one film festival in Long Island where they partnered up with a food truck. And that food truck created a sandwich for each film that was in the festival. And I thought that was really cool. So we took our own spin on that and we worked with local businesses, restaurants and cafes and things like that to create drink specials for the weekend. So just taking those like cool ideas and experiences we had and just bringing that to New Bedford.
So last year was your first year. What were some of the takeaways that you had from that you're carrying forward to help shape the festival this year?
I mean, honestly, last year was insane. It you know, exceeded expectations. And I think it was really more about just expanding on the things that we did last year, because it seemed like we really, our first year, we tried to do as much as we could without overwhelming ourselves, but we tried to do a lot of different things and really give people a little taste of everything that we wanted to offer. And the response from that was incredible. So we just kind of like doubled down on all of those things and try to expand and try to give better experiences. But I think the one unique thing that we really kept at the forefront was we're not just inviting people to come here and watch films with us. We're inviting them to New Bedford. We're inviting them to take part in this embracive culture and community here and really give them that New Bedford experience, because I know that when people visit New Bedford is when they really get that insight of what we all love about it. So just keeping that at the forefront, bringing people in, getting the local businesses and local venues and organizations involved in it. And it really feels like the whole city is behind it.
We know what a thriving arts community New Bedford has. I never realized how many filmmakers there are. Do you remember off the top of your head how many films the New Bedford Film Festival has coming into it from local filmmakers?
From local? I'm not too sure. I'd say a solid, maybe like, I don't know, maybe somewhere between like 20 and 30, because it's not necessarily like the entire project was made by local people, but maybe a local person was involved. Like they were, you know, the editor on it or the sound engineer on it or something. But there is a little bit of New Bedford in
20 and 30 is a lot.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe that's exaggerated.
Yeah. But just thinking what goes into making a film. That's such an undertaking. Let's talk about filmmaking on the South Coast and in New Bedford. There is a lot that goes into making a film, from actors to camera operators, location, sound. Is there a community of folks doing this work on the South Coast? Actually, let's open the mic. What do you say? Anyone can start here. Is there, you have each made a film and employed, you know, or brought together people from the South Coast? Karen.
Well, actually, my film does not take place in New Bedford, and the people that I got together were people from Boston College Film Studies, where I had, you know, I taught in the School of Social Work there for 20 years, and at some point got connected with the chair of the Film Studies about doing social justice documentaries. They have they had a grant for students to do a documentary on social justice, and they would pay, you know, the students, you know, whatever expenses they had. And so I partnered with Professor Mikulchik, who was the chair at that time of the program, and he helped, you know, find a student for me, and then we took it from there. And so this film that I just produced was filmed in India, in South India.
Let's take a moment just to talk about your film so that we can set it up so people understand what we're talking about here. Your film's a documentary. It's titled Women of Truth and Courage, and it's an extension of your work with the nonprofit Kalungurai. Tell us about the nonprofit.
Okay. The nonprofit began right after the Indian Ocean tsunami. A few days after the tsunami, several Jesuits came to this area of South India that was the most devastated area from the tsunami in India, and decided that they were going to provide assistance and relief to the survivors. They did a needs assessment, and one of the groups that seemed to be in most need were widowed or abandoned women, because these women were not getting any relief or assistance from the government, because women cannot be heads of households, and they were only giving relief to heads of households. So NGO, the non-governmental organization, Kalungurai, decided to stay there indefinitely and work with these people in providing for them and helping them with employment and survival, their survivorship.
So the film is about widows in India who are often ostracized and sidelined, so they can't work or support their families. What prompted you to make this documentary, and did you have a background in filmmaking going into this?
No, I had no background in filmmaking. And but this particular time, we made two documentaries in the past 20 years. And this one, I, you know, because I followed this group for, you know, many years now, I wanted to inspire people in terms of the tenacity, the resilience and strength of these women who were considered, like you said, ostracized and not treated well because of their status of being widows, and how they challenged the society and, you know, the traditions around being, you know, how you treat widows. They, like you said, they were ostracized. They're prohibited from wearing jewelry and nice clothing, and leaving their homes, you know. So I wanted to really show how these women got together, developed a movement to the point where now they're making changes on a social level in terms of their treatment.
Were there what were some of the challenges or unexpected moments as you were doing this? I imagine an undertaking like this that's, you know, you're moving into, you're taking people's lives, you're documenting people's lives, and you're doing something that you've never done before. Were there some moments that stand out for you?
Well, so this one was different from others that I've done in terms of I wanted to follow a widowed woman in her daily life. And I actually spent a couple days back in 2023, just watching, following, observing the woman and interviewing her. And so she's kind of the main character of the film. We, see what she does in the morning as she gets up and, is cooking her meals and milking her cow and, how she goes through her daily life. And that was, before when I had gone to India, I'd always spent, some time in the villages or meeting with self-help groups and so on. But I'd never really got to, kind of live a life of a widow. So that was kind of different. And so I started by going there in 2023 and just spending time with her and developing a relationship. And then when I came back in 2024 to do the film, I felt, we had a rapport, we had a relationship that she would be, very open and easy to work with.
Describe some of the ways that this societal shunning that your film is focusing on, how it impacts women and their families.
Well, basically, they've been referred to as the poorest of the poor in India. So they live in poverty. When you talk about the whole family, first of all, the widow is often kind of considered impure or unlucky, bad luck. People don't want to do business with them. They don't want them around and, at certain events, like even their children's weddings, they don't want them to be there. And the children can experience some feelings of shame and stigma, having a mother who is widowed. Mm. So it really affects their whole lives. And one reason I like this NGO there is that they see the whole picture and they help with the children's education and with the children. They help first with, the women being parts of self-help groups where they can start supporting each mm-hmm. other. They now, wear the jewelry, they wear flowers in their hair, they dress nicely, and they have a self-esteem and dignity about them. And then they are given microcredit loans where they can start businesses or pay off debts, whatever. So economically, they're improving, and just in terms of their individual self-esteem and respect. And like I said earlier, it has led to a movement where they're making further changes in the society.
I'm wondering about this documentary that you made. Did you get an opportunity to screen it for the participants? And what was their reaction?
Yes, we screened it for the staff at first. And the widows themselves have not seen it yet. But the staff felt really positive about it. And we wanted to, again, show the resilience and the strength, the empowerment of the widows, and not just the problems and the issues and, the negative things. So they felt very good about it.
You are listening to The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, and for Mindy Todd, we're discussing the New Bedford Film Festival, which is in its second year and is taking place this week, starting April 10th and running through the 13th. And we are talking with Film Festival Director and three South Coast filmmakers about the festival. And we are going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back. You're listening to The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. In for Mindy Todd, we are discussing the New Bedford Film Festival, which starts tomorrow and runs through the weekend. It's the second year for the film festival. We're talking with the festival director and three South Coast filmmakers. I want to talk to Julian Pedro next. And Julian, your film is a short feature titled Better Than I Was. Give us a synopsis of the film and why this story was one that you wanted to tell.
Yeah, so my film is about a non-binary individual named Jean who returns home after kind of being estranged from their family for about 6 years. They return home on Thanksgiving, kind of hoping to reconnect with their siblings and their parents, whom they had a pretty tough relationship with. And so their parents are very conservative. The siblings very mad that their older sibling had left for so long. And so it's kind of just about navigating your home and family life when your family's views on who you are differ on the kind of person that you want to be. It was a script that was written by my best friend. I'm personally non-binary, so I could relate to the character and kind of what they were going through. And I think it's just really important for stories of marginalized communities to kind of be shared. They're not really represented in the community as much as they should be. I mean, especially with the way that things are going right now. I mean, we're kind of just told that we don't really exist. So I think it's really important at this time that, like, those kind of stories are told and that we remind people that we are here.
Tell us some more about the setting and the making of this film. How long did it take to make, and how did you put this together as the filmmaker?
Yeah, so the script was written probably about 9 months before we shot it. We were planning on filming it as like a passion project, my friends and I. It ended up being my thesis film at college. We need another project to work on, so we were like, might as well just make it now, get it out there. It's a good story to tell. Everybody liked it. Sorry, can you remind me?
The locations.
The locations, yeah. Okay, so I believe when the script was written, the writer is from Massachusetts as well, so it kind of, at the heart of it, always had, like, a Northeastern vibe, but I went to school at the Savannah College of Art and Design in Georgia, so we ended up having to, like, tweak a couple of things, and we shot in Savannah. But, like I said, the writer, my cinematographer, and myself were all from Massachusetts, so we all kind of carry that with us throughout the filmmaking process.
And you're based in New Bedford.
I'm based in Dartmouth, yes.
In Dartmouth, mm-hmm. In the South Coast. Mm-hmm. And I started out the show kind of talking a little bit about the community of filmmakers that exists on the South Coast. Does it feel like there's a real, as you're working on this film, it takes a long time to make a film, mm-hmm. Are you in a supportive community or in contact with other filmmakers?
I mean, yeah, for sure. I like I said, I went to school in Georgia, so I didn't realize just how much of a big filmmaking community there was until I attended the film festival last year, in its first year, and I met a lot of filmmakers in the area, and I actually shot a narrative short over the summer. And some of the contacts that I made at the film festival were there to help me a lot through the fundraising process and kind of just planning out my film. And I'm so grateful for their help that they gave me during pre-production. But yeah, it was because of the film festival that I was able to meet other filmmakers in the area and kind of get the help that I needed.
Ethan, that's like the testimony right there. Your first film festival last year and really connecting people in the community. So not only sort of elevating the work of people, but bringing people together.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just about, you know, come watch all these cool films with us. That's one aspect of it. But we wanted to just be more than that. We wanted to really, you know, help build and foster this filmmaking community as both, you know, an economic driver and tourism driver to the city, but also as a resource for local filmmakers to get this kind of stronger foundation than they would have if they just, like, you know, up and moved to, like, a New York or an L.A. or something like that. We want to make sure that local filmmakers have that supportive community, have those resources to tap into. And, you know, selfishly, if somebody, you know, wants to go to New York or L.A., that's cool. But I don't want anybody to ever feel like they have to leave the area to make it, to be successful in this realm. So we just wanted to make sure that we, you know, again, gave as many resources as we could. But I think the most important thing is really just connecting people, because you never know, you know, a great opportunity is usually just one conversation away. And we just wanted to provide an environment for that to happen.
Julian, I want to come back to your film, Better Than I Was. It has young adult actors in it, and mm-hmm. they do a great job. Tell us about putting together that cast.
Yeah, so I got really lucky. I'd worked with one of the actors on previous projects, and I did a study abroad program where another one was, and I minored in acting, and I had a class with the third young adult actor. And I, like I said, I just got really lucky. We were all kind of, they knew who I was. I'd been working on a lot of projects around my school, so everybody kind of knew who I was. And so they were all also actors that got represented by, like, the Performing Arts Senior Showcase at SCAD, where it's like, you have to audition for it, and it's like the top 12. So they were all, like, really good friends, and they were all interested in the story. Two of them, one of my actors is trans, and another one of them was non-binary, and so they also, like, really connected to the story that we were trying to tell and wanted to be a part of it.
Lila Woodbridge, let's bring you in here. Your film is also a short feature. The title is Interference. Tell us about the film. Give us a little synopsis and why this was a story for you to tell.
Yeah, so...
Come a little bit closer to that mic. Yeah.
Interference is a short psychological horror film. It's about one teenage boy's sort of struggle with identity and paranoia amidst the start of the AIDS crisis in the early 1980s, so a bit of a period piece. We talk a lot about media and identity and sort of how what you're absorbing from TV and radio and the news and how that can impact as you grow up, especially as a teenager, how you see yourself, especially looking at that through a queer lens.
Your film also features young adults, and a lot of the film is focused on one character. It doesn't have a lot of dialogue, so he's really carrying the scenes. Tell us more about directing an actor like through an experience like this.
Yeah, this is the sort of first film that I've directed outside of college, so it was a very new experience for me, but it was just wonderful. I mean, we had the most talented actors that were... My lead, J.D. Robinson, was just so ready to give this, like, his all. Even though we were, you know, pushing long hours, it was very much a passion project. But just sort of having that ability to go back and forth with him on the script, and all of our actors, I felt like, really understood what we wanted to say with the film, and were just, you know, very passionate and happy to be there.
Because there isn't a lot of dialogue in this, music becomes very integral to the film. Talk about finding the right music for the scenes.
I would love to talk about that. My father actually is the composer of our score. So a lot of our, I would say the majority of our post-production process has been me and him just getting the opportunity to work, like, really closely and bring the story to life through the score and the sound design. I think he did an incredible job. It's been such a fun experience to be able to work with him on this. And a lot of the score, actually, it was very non-traditional in the sense that the sound design was almost, like, interlinked with the score. A lot of the horror elements are sound effects and sort of diegetic audio from the television and from the real world of the film. So we worked to interlink those with the score and sort of bring out those elements and, you know, really highlighting the analog technology of the 80s and giving it a lot of texture. And it's just been, yeah, I think one of the most sort of artistic processes of the film.
The film is set in what I think is the 1980s. And
yes.
Talk a little bit about designing or recreating the 1980s as a set design and an experience for people.
That was definitely one of the biggest challenges, being a low budget, no budget indie film, to have to recreate and make sure everything was in line with the era. Our production designer, Diz, was absolutely incredible. They came on pretty last minute and absolutely just transformed the film with, you know, their know-how and their design skills. We did a lot of sort of prop effects that were kind of new things that we had to invent. You know, we had to film a lot of content that took place on CRT TVs, and we actually shot content for specifically to be shown as a character watching it on the TV. But if you know a little bit about those kinds of TVs, when you film them with a digital camera, you get a lot of lines and just they don't look very good. So what we actually did was we went to a Saber TV in Fall River, and we brought them some old CRT TVs that we had found and asked them to remove the television from inside them, leaving us with just the frame, which they thought was a very odd request, but we're happy to do. And then so what we would do is we had a We had a 3D printer, this company called Borobot. They're also a local 3D printing sort of collaborative company. And they printed us a like new television bevel so that because when you remove the CRT TV, you have to remove, a little bit overcomplicated, the inside of the frame. So, you know, we had 3D printing aspects of it. And then we also had to find basically iPads and televisions that would fit inside the TV. Mm. And so we were able to have that be a digital screen inside and be able to edit, you know, use DaVinci Resolve and color grade on set as we're shooting. Very complicated process that basically just my partner and my dad and I all figured out over one summer, but just such a fun experience.
So before we went on, you were saying that you shot it in 2022?
Yes.
And it's been in production ever since then.
Yeah. I mean, this is, definitely a passion project for everyone involved and sort of a very close network of us doing the final touches on this. So, you know, between full-time jobs and also, I've, you know, been living in L.A. and New York and also spending time in South Coast during all of that. It's been a slow process, but I'm super excited to finally have it out there.
No kidding. Making a film is one thing, but getting it seen by audiences is another job. Karen, when you were conceiving of your film about the women of truth and courage, what were your plans for getting it in front of an audience?
Well, I was thinking of it as more of a teaching tool or educational tool for people in general. I mean, women and also, you know, students. And it, probably that comes from my background being a professor. That's something I do is teach. And so I have a nonprofit here in New Bedford that supports Kalungri and their programs. And I thought that it would be a good way for them to raise awareness about what we're doing here to help and work with them in India. And so that's basically what I was hoping that, you know, we could show it to people who are interested in this topic of gender equality and have maybe interest in another culture like India. So that's, who it was directed to.
Julian, same question for you. You make this film, and now you have to get it in front of people. Is this its introduction to the world through the New Bedford Film Festival?
Yeah. So my film was chosen by SCAD to kind of be put on a festival run along with other thesis films that did pretty well in the program. And no such luck, but that's okay. It happens. But then I went to the New Bedford, the film festival last year. And I thought kind of the time for Better Than I was over after it didn't really get accepted into anything. I didn't have enough of a budget to keep submitting it on my own to a bunch of different festivals. It costs a lot of money to keep submitting your film over and over again. But I was like, well, you know what? I'll take my chance with New Bedford. I was like, I'll put my baby out there one last time. At least if it gets shown there, then I have a chance at like showing filmmakers in the area kind of what I have to offer and to try to make those connections with people in the area. So
that's exciting. Lila, how about getting interference in front of audiences and how important are smaller and local film festivals like the one in New Bedford for screening short films?
Yeah, you know, being my first narrative short, this has been a really interesting intro into the sort of festival circuit, and we definitely have been like shooting for the stars with this. We had our very first premiere this past Friday in Manhattan, and so that was cool. A lot of our sort of New York local crew got to come and sort of treat it as a little bit of a reunion. And then this is our first sort of Massachusetts premiere, which is also amazing because so much of our crew and cast is from this area too. So they'll get the chance to see it there. But we definitely have, I think the mix has been really important to me of shooting for large festivals and seeing how you do. I have some exciting news that I can't quite announce yet, but definitely have enjoyed, and it's starting to pay off to do the larger festivals. But I do feel like the smaller festivals are sort of where I'm going to really start to meet people and make connections.
You are listening to The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker in for Mindy Todd. We're discussing the New Bedford Film Festival, which is in its second year. It launches tomorrow and runs through the weekend. We're speaking to the film festival director and three South Coast filmmakers. We'll take a short break now. We're back in a moment. You're listening to The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, in for Mindy Todd. We're discussing the New Bedford Film Festival, which launches tomorrow and runs through the weekend. It's the second year for the film festival. We're speaking with the festival director, Ethan D'Aguiar, and with three filmmakers from the South Coast, Karen Kaiser, Lila Woodbridge, and Julian Pedro. Ethan, the New Bedford Film Festival is also screening student films. Tell us more about this category and some of the films.
Yeah, so we recognize that a lot of the filmmakers that are still in school are working on theses. They're at this kind of like transitional period where it's like I'm leaving school where I had all this kind of direction and things and getting out into the world and finding themselves and finding their path and what they want to do. So we just wanted to offer an opportunity to highlight that while also, inviting them to the festival so they could already get their feet wet and start making these connections and start talking with other people and really start building their own networks. I won't speak about any of the films specifically. What I will say about the category as a whole is you watch some of these student films, and if I didn't tell you it was a student film, you would think it was a big production. Like, there is no... just because it has that student film label, I think sometimes people have an expectation that it's like, oh, it's these kids and still in school having fun. No, they're taking this super seriously. I've drawn inspiration. I've learned things from, talking with them or just watching their films. And it's just incredible to be able to offer that opportunity for students. One of the things we wanted to do with the film festival was help New Bedford expand their TV and film capabilities. And one of the ways of doing that is connecting directly with these educational institutions to try to create this sort of education to industry pipeline. I think film school is great if people decide to go that route, but I also think it's not the only opportunity for young filmmakers. So giving them this space where they can see that, they already have what it takes and they can already kind of pursue more precisely what they want to do instead of just go into more schooling and oftentimes more student debt and things like that. It was just showing them another avenue and just working with them to, not just showcase their films, but offer resources and offer support when they leave that school. So they know, hey, in the real world, you still have this support, you have this community, and you have these resources that you can tap into.
Now, you're also offering PSA films. Tell us about this category.
Yeah, PSA is a very interesting category because they're not...
Public service announcements.
Yeah, service announcements, but it's not really what you always think. It's not always, here's this event or this cause or something like that. A lot of the times, one of our PSAs is called Catch the Tradition, and it was submitted from New Bedford Fishing Heritage Center. It's almost like a PSA for New Bedford and for the culture of New Bedford, being a port city, being, the number one fishing port in America. It's just kind of like a PSA of that aspect of it, which contributes to the overall culture of New Bedford and what makes New Bedford a unique place. We have this great seafood. We have all of these, restaurants and things like that were really like people travel all over just to come get some seafood in New Bedford. But it just kind of dives a little bit deeper into that, into the people that make that happen, the fishermen that go out and really brave these waters and do this so that we can have this unique thing in our city. So, PSAs are interesting because it's not what you think it is.
In addition to the film screenings, there will be panel workshops as part of the festival. Any particular ones you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, I am running a workshop, or not a workshop, a panel discussion where we actually get to highlight local filmmakers and do kind of like what we're doing here today, ask them more about their process, how it was making their films, give them that spotlight and that time to shine. we have workshops. My buddy Dan is running a workshop on color grading, so like an aspect of post-production where you can get some advice on things that honestly kind of fall by the wayside sometimes. It's you know, he specializes in this, so you're getting firsthand experience from somebody who spends a lot of time on color grading, more so than like somebody like me who has to, you know, I usually do the whole I'm shooting and then I'm editing and then I'm marketing it and rolling it out. Something's going to suffer for that. So getting that firsthand advice for somebody that really like is passionate about this one aspect of post-production. And another one I'm super excited about is how to fund your film, because that's a hugely important thing for people to know and get more resources about, where whether you're trying to get funds to do a film festival run or just to make your production, there are so many avenues and so many resources out there for people. But one, they don't know about all of them, and two, when they do know about them, they don't know how to maximize it. So we're just kind of offering these resources to people to help them beyond just making the films.
Let me go around the table with that, because I'm curious, each of you is completed a film here that's showing at the festival, but it's such an enormous undertaking. How did you fund it? Lila, let's start with you. What approach do you take to funding a film?
Yeah, we actually took the route of doing an Indiegogo Kickstarter, and it was a really great process. You know, it's a lot of work. You have to do a lot of social media marketing and a lot of networking and a lot of communication with people, but we offered some really fun perks. You know, where we offered the film on VHS with a custom slipcase and the score on cassette, sort of taking advantage of a little bit of the 80s fun. But we found our executive producer just from basically putting out what our intentions with the film and what our goals were out on social media, and, you know, just happened to find the right audience with some TikTok videos. And just really feels very special to not only have the local, you know, community network. I'm learning that some of our sponsors were actually people that, you know, are on the film festival board that I hadn't even met yet. So to get that sort of local support, and then you also are reaching a wider audience of people, you know, from all over the world.
Sounds like you have to get creative.
Yes,
as you're
doing
this.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost an aspect of, you know, you have to be ready to do a lot of video production and editing to, you know, make the short form videos that are sort of getting out there, and also, you know, make the perks appealing and interesting and exciting.
So Indiegogo is like a crowdsourcing funding model. And Julian, you use this too, is that right?
Mm-hmm. I used it both for Better Than I Was and the most recent film that I shot this past summer. Like Lila said, lots of trying to brainstorm fun perks to get people interested in donating like a certain amount to get what those different levels. And then it's just about sending it to quite literally every single person that you can think of and telling them to send it to every single person that they can think of. And just trying to get as many people to see your project as possible, and then maybe some stuff will trickle in. So just like keep expanding your net, even if you haven't talked to someone in years, if you had a good relationship with them, be like, hey, I'm making this thing. We haven't talked in a while, but wouldn't it be cool if you helped me with it?
To be able to get people to buy into your vision for a film that doesn't exist yet, that must be
it's hard.
Its own thing. Yes, it's its own kind of conversation.
Mm-hmm. Just like lots of like, why are you doing it? Like, why is it important for you to want to make this? How is it going to help your future? Like stuff like that. Part of it is selling your film. Another half of it is selling yourself.
Karen, how about you? When it came to funding this,
how
did you approach it?
Well, I'm in a little different situation. The first two that I made was when I was a professor at Boston College. And so it was part of my job to, you know, do something like this. And I was taking students over to India for a course. And so I just incorporated, you know, making films and also using the film study students who had the grant to support them. So it's just kind of pulling things together like that made it possible. And so
it's a little, I was in a little different situation than.
It sounds like every film is its own situation in a way. Ethan, so we know there's a lot of New Bedford focus here, but are there foreign films in the festival too?
Oh, yeah, for sure. We have films from India. We have films from Asia. We have confirmed filmmaker or their team from Belgium making it to the festival, and also a team from the UK making it to the festival. And last year, we had people from Germany, Rwanda, France. Like, yeah, I mean, first year, we could already call ourselves an international film festival. And I think that's really, it's twofold. It's one, we get to, you know, like Karen had mentioned before, you're exposing people to cultures that they don't always get some of this kind of in-depth storytelling about and really like get a feel for these other cultures, but you're also bringing these people to New Bedford, which is really unique. And the consensus was, you know, once people are here, they see the magic that we all see in New Bedford every day. So that's been one of the most rewarding things is, you know, expanding our reach and just building community even from so far away.
I'd love to hear what film or films you are looking forward to seeing at the festival and kind of go around the table. Lila, let's start with you. Have you been looking over the program saying, ooh, I want to see that?
I know I love the sort of programming of all the different sections. I know there's sort of like a queer film section that I would love to see. I know there's sort of a bigger budget with some names, big names in it called Hearts of Stone, I think. That looks very cool. It's just been really awesome to see all of the huge variety that's going to be there.
Julian, are there some particular types of films or films in themselves that you've identified that...
I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing the two blocks of local filmmakers just because I really go for the networking opportunities and meeting new people. But there are some South Coast filmmakers. I mean, like Lila, your film isn't in one of the local blocks, right? So I've been looking at who's nominated for the best filmmaker of the year kind of thing and being like, because not all of yours are in a local film block, so let me go find you somewhere else. But yeah.
And Karen?
Yes. Well, I'm interested in the documentaries and seeing how other people are doing them. And after listening to Lila and Julian, I'd like to see their films.
There are events happening throughout this period, too. You were talking about one where people will be reciting screenplays, Ethan. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so we, you know, along with the workshops and the panel discussions, we just want to create a more just unique experiences for people attending the festival, both local and from out of town. So we have things like a filmmaker's breakfast or brunch, which is the first Friday. It's the first, you know, first full day of screenings and everything where all of the filmmakers just have an opportunity to mix and mingle and meet each other. Because then at night on Friday and Saturday, we have networking nights. Where, you know, we can come in, we can talk shop, we can make connections, you know, exchange information, that kind of thing. But we also use that opportunity to highlight some of the films and give some awards. So the first networking night is honoring the film and music. So we have, you know, we're giving some awards out for the music videos and for some of the music aspects of the films. And we're having some of the bands and performers that submitted music videos to the festival playing their music live. So you get to experience that. And some of them are playing the songs that they have in that. Some of them are playing like an acoustic version of that song. So you get a little bit of different experience. You get to meet these people and talk with them. And then the second networking night, we're honoring the screenwriters. So we have a collection of actors called The Collective in New Bedford that are, they've rehearsed, they've grabbed some scripts from some of these films, and they're basically acting out, some, you know, really, really good scenes from some of these films, and they'll be scattered around the Harbor Hotel during that night. So people can kind of like tune into these conversations and just really get, I mean, really see like the, what it's kind of like to be on set without being on set, but just seeing these different aspects of filmmaking outside of just watching the final product and enjoying that. And we're doing it all together when we can, you know, talk to each other and build those networks. It's really, we just wanted to create this kind of unique experience for people.
It sounds like a fun way to break the fourth wall and bring people into the experience of these films. I want to talk about some of the practical aspects for people who want to attend the festival. Now, there's some screenings and workshops available for no cost, but I know seating is limited. What's the best way for people to plan to see films or to participate in other events here?
I mean, the most sure shot way would obviously be buying the full package. You get access to every single thing of the film festival, you know, guaranteed seats, all of that stuff. We wanted to make it as accessible for people as possible. So all of the screenings are and workshops and panels are free. Non-ticket holders just have to show up 5 minutes before the start time. And then if we have capacity, we let everybody in. We've, you know, last year we only ran into, I think, one, maybe two issues of things being at capacity because they were so popular. But we made sure to get bigger venues for those specific things this year. And the only events where you need tickets for would be the networking nights and the award, the pre-cocktail or pre-award show cocktail hour and the award show. But yeah, other than that, I mean, we just want to be as inclusive as possible and bring, you know, give the opportunity for filmmakers to experience the full festival. Filmmakers get a free pass when they submit, and also just let the audience come in and let local people come in and kind of see what it's all about and make those connections too.
Talk about the venues. Where are people going to be to participate in this?
Yeah, so most of our screenings take place between Gallery X and Steeple Playhouse, which are right next door to each other, which is great in case you have to hop between screenings because we are showing a lot of films. We're showing either just under or just over 100 films. Gallery X is an art gallery in New Bedford that has a great production space, projection system. And Steeple Playhouse is an old church that got renovated to be this stage theater location. We're also showing, we're having the filmmakers brunch I mentioned will be right before a screening at the New Bedford Art Museum. And then we're also showing the NB48, which is our take on a 48-hour film challenge at the New Bedford Whaling Museum. And then the networking nights will be hosted at Harbor Hotel.
It must be a tremendous job just to whittle down the submissions for something like this.
Yeah, I mean, we had, I think the number was like 238 submissions or something like that, like just under 250. And it's, I mean, you're choosing to not include films that are amazing. Mm. Like it's the hard decision. Our initial round of looking at the films. We give it out to community judges where they can kind of like sign up. We send them a chunk of films, like 10, 15 at a time. They look through it. They kind of give their ratings. So we get more of a feel of audience members' reception to it outside of just people who have that filmmaking experience. Because I think a filmmaker is going to watch a film a little bit differently than somebody who's not in that world. So we like to kind of vary it up. But yeah, I mean, it's tough decisions. It's the hardest part, I think, of running the festival is really deciding, you know, which ones you have to unfortunately not include. But yeah.
Hmm. We have been discussing the New Bedford Film Festival, which is undertaking its second year. It begins tomorrow, runs through the weekend, April 10th through the 13th. The festival showcases diverse human experiences through an array of formats, short and feature films, music videos, student films, and documentaries. And we have been speaking with the festival director, Ethan D'Aguiar. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Karen Kaiser, filmmaker of Women of Truth and Courage. Karen, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And we were speaking with Julian Pedro, filmmaker for Better Than I Was.
Thank you.
And Lila Woodbridge, filmmaker for Interference.
Well,
thank you, Lila. Such an enormous amount of work you've done, and how exciting. Congratulations on bringing it to the film festival, each of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Steve Junker in for Mindy Todd. That's it for today. We'll talk to you soon.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.